Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This month's tape is by Roger Dawson. Roger is one of the country's top experts in the art of negotiating. Success Magazine calls him America's premier business negotiator. His cassette program, Secrets of Power Negotiating, has passed the $20 million sales mark and is the largest selling program in the history of business cassette publishing. Roger has written 6 books, the latest of which is Roger Dawson's Secrets of Power Negotiating from Career Press. This book was featured in the main section of the Money Book Club and was the first book ever to be excerpted in an 8-page supplement both in Success Magazine and Working Women Magazine. Roger was born in England and came to this country in 1962. His business background includes being president of one of California's largest real estate companies, with 28 offices, 540 sales associates, and a volume of over $400 million per year. As a full-time speaker since 1982, he has trained managers and salespeople at the top companies throughout the United States, Canada, and Australia. All of us negotiate every day. It may be with an employee, a customer, our suppliers, or perhaps the next-door neighbor, but we all do it. This month, you will have the opportunity to pick up negotiating tips from one of the top trainers in the world. Listen closely. It may just make a significant difference in your bottom line.
I've worked with contractors from Anchorage, Alaska to the Virgin Islands and from Boston to San Diego, and everybody tells me the same thing, that it's getting tougher out there, that the people with whom you do business are getting to be better negotiators than they were ever before, and that to make a profit as a contractor, you simply have to sharpen up your negotiating skills. You simply have to do better at it. So this program is especially for you. I want to teach you the skills that will make you a power negotiator. I want you to have everything you need to control the other person in the negotiating process. But then I want you to only use that power and control when it's to both people's advantage, a win-win negotiation. I want to teach you how you can get anything you want. And you really can get anything you want if you'll just realize these 5 things. Number one, you're negotiating all the time. Negotiating is not just for prison wardens, FBI agents, or union negotiators. Anytime you're eyeball to eyeball, belly button to belly button, kneecap to kneecap, toe to toe with another human being, you're negotiating. And if you know how to do it right, if you know how to structure a negotiation so it's a win-win, so that the other people get what they want, but at the same time you get what you want, not only will you be a lot more successful as a contractor, but a lot of the pressure and the stress and the friction will go out of your life. Because what was formerly a big problem for you, such as a general leaning on you for price concessions, or a supplier backing down on a delivery commitment, now becomes fun because you understand the dimensions of what's going on and you know how to handle it. Number 2 is the realization that anything you'll ever want in life is presently owned or controlled by somebody else. This is not 1849, where you could buy a sluice box down at the hardware store, head for the hills of California, and pick up gold and become wealthy, because it is laying out there. Everything is presently owned or controlled by somebody else. So doesn't it make sense that we spend a little time learning how to get it, just in case we ever need it? And how to get it in such a way that we're not dominating people, we're not turning people off, but we're turning people on to us because we know how to get them what they want. At the same time, we get what we want. So we should all be spending an awful lot of time studying negotiating. Yet it's amazing to me how few people have. In 1985, my daughter Julia graduated from USC in Southern California. She graduated from the business school, one of the finest business schools in the country. In fact, certainly one of the most expensive. It cost over $50,000 to put her through that school, but she didn't get 1 hour of negotiating training. So she came away from it feeling that business had to do with reading spreadsheets, studying profit and loss statements, and understanding the mechanics of running a business. And what she's found out is what you and every other contractor has found out, that the key to success in business is not in the mechanics, But the key is in handling people. In negotiating with the generals and with the subs and with the unions, your employees, your suppliers, and your customers, the art of negotiating is so critical to you getting what you want. Number three is the understanding that there are some predictable responses to the maneuvers that take place in a negotiating situation. I call these maneuvers gambits. That's a chess term, which means any maneuver for advantage. For example, whenever you say yes to the first offer, you set up two predictable responses. Let me have you tell me what those responses are. Let's say, for example, that you're interested in acquiring another truck for your business, and a contractor across town has one for sale, and they're asking $10,000 for it, which is a terrific price. But you say to yourself, I'll be a good negotiator. I'll make them a super low offer of $8,000. Sure, they're going to get angry with me. It's such a low offer, they'll probably throw me out on my ear the minute they hear about it. But then maybe we'll end up splitting the difference, and it'll be an even better buy. I'll make them a really low offer just to see what happens. So you go on in, and you sit down with the partners who own the truck, and you present the $8,000 offer. And you wait for them to explode with rage at such a low offer. But what actually happens is one partner looks at the other and says, well, what do you think, Joe? And Joe says, oh, why don't we go ahead and take it and get rid of it anyway? What's your response when they say yes to an offer that you didn't expect them to accept? Well, I'm fairly sure that your first response will be, I could have done better. I maybe could have got it for $6,000. In actual fact, if you'd have taken them the $6,000 offer and they'd accepted it, you still would have thought, I could have done better. You see, it has nothing to do with the price. It only has to do with the way people say yes to you. What would your second response be if they jumped at an offer on the truck that you didn't expect them to take? Probably, there's something wrong with the truck. There's something wrong here that I didn't figure out. Those two responses are so predictable that in seminars around the country that I've conducted, when I ask the audience for their response to that situation, I always get those two responses to that situation and always in that order. So part of the art of power negotiating, on which we'll spend quite a bit of time, is learning that there are predictable responses to the maneuvers that take place. I'm a firm believer in win-win negotiating. Instead of the style of negotiating that says we should dominate the other person and outsmart them and trick them into doing things that they wouldn't normally do, I believe power negotiators should sit down and honestly work out their problems together and arrive at a situation where both of them can win. Your reaction to that may be, Roger, you obviously don't know much about the contracting business. I live in a dog-eat-dog world out there. These guys don't take any prisoners. They eat their young. There's no such thing as win-win in the contracting business. If I'm trying to hire a subcontractor, for example, I'm obviously trying to get the lowest price for the job I possibly can. And they're obviously trying to get the highest possible price they can for the work. How on earth can we both win in the negotiation? So let's start out with the most important issue. How do power negotiators arrive at win-win solutions? There are three fundamental rules to observe. Rule number one is, don't narrow the negotiation down to just one issue. If you do that, for example, if you're only talking about price, I agree with you. Somebody does have to win, and somebody does have to lose. But there are always more issues than that in any negotiation. It's fascinating to study some of the international negotiations that go on and see the mistakes that are made and the elements that come together to contribute to the solution or lack of the solution. Take the Falkland Islands crisis, for example. I paid close attention to that because I was originally from England. I saw it as the last great flourish of the British Empire. And the thought of Prince Andrew, who has never done a stroke of work in his life, and apparently never intends to do a stroke of work in his life, leading the charge of the British Navy down the Atlantic to recapture all those sheep, was almost as much as I could stand. But if you look at the negotiation in the Falkland Island crisis, and you see only one issue, who occupies the islands, the Argentines or the British, of course there has to be a winner, and there has to be a loser. But in actual fact, there were many more elements than that in the negotiation, weren't there? There was the prestige of the two nations. There were the political futures of the leaders involved. In fact, who occupied the islands was of minor importance. The problem arose when the generals who ran Argentina realized that they were losing the support of the people. they needed an issue around which to rally the people. So they picked on a group of Portuguese islands just off their coast and said to the Portuguese, "We're going to take our islands back." You know what the Portuguese said? They said, "You can have them. What do we need with some lumps of rock in the South Atlantic?" Well, that didn't help any, so they turned to the British and said, "We're going to take the Malvinas back." And it just so happened that Margaret Thatcher was losing power in England, and she was looking for a rallying issue also. And the fight was on. Who occupied the islands was of minor importance to anyone. There are always many more elements than just the one main issue that are important in negotiations. So the art of win-win negotiating is to piece together those elements, like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, so that both people can win. So rule one is, don't narrow the negotiations down to just one issue. At a seminar once, a developer came up to me. He was very excited, he told me, because he'd almost completed negotiating the contract for a very large commercial building. "We've been working on it now for over a year," he said, "and we've almost got it resolved. In fact, we've resolved everything except price, and we're only $72,000 apart." Well, I flinch when I hear things like that, because I know from now on, however much work he's put into it, now he's narrowed it down to just one issue. And there has to be a winner, and there has to be a loser. And however close they may be, they could still be heading for trouble. So while we may establish momentum in the negotiations by finding a common ground on small issues, a gambit we'll talk about later when we talk about power negotiating, we should never absolutely nail down all of the other factors so that you've narrowed it down to one issue. Rule number two that makes you a win-win power negotiator is the understanding that people are not out for the same thing. You know, we all have an almost overriding tendency to assume that other people want what we want, that what's important to us will be important to them, but that's not true. In fact, we all have a unique perspective of the world in which we live. There are over 5 billion people in the world, and nobody sees things just the way that you do. And the assumption that they want what you want can never lead to a win-win negotiation. If I were to hold out my hand with my palm facing you and ask you to describe my hand, and then I describe my hand, we'd get two totally different descriptions, wouldn't we? But it's not a question of one of us being right and one of us being wrong. We're both right. We're just seeing things from a different perspective. This is one of those things that's so simplistic, it's so easy to understand, and yet it's so very, very profound. Half of the problems in the world would go away today if people understood that with very few exceptions, people are not right or wrong. They're just seeing things from a different perspective. I was flying up to do a seminar in Anchorage, Alaska one time, and found myself seated next to Billy Graham, who was going up there to do an evangelistic crusade. And we talked for a while about power negotiating. And he was the one that really brought it to my attention that there are some exceptions to this rule, that there is existence of sheer evil in the world. He pointed out the Ayatollah Khomeini and President Gaddafi of Libya. Sheer evil does exist in the world. So we'll make those exceptions. But apart from just a few, people are not right or wrong. They're just seeing things from a different perspective. This is very important for you as a supervisor. It's quite common for some of your workers to come to you with the heat on. They're in a temper. They're in a rage. They're threatening to quit, possibly. And they're saying, here's the conflict, here's what we're arguing about. And their assumption is that one of them is right and one of them is wrong. And they've come to you to make a decision as to who's right and who's wrong. Now that puts you, as we Americans say, between a rock and a hard place, doesn't it? Whichever way you go, you're going to lose one of them. But if you just take the time to point out that it's not a question of one being right and the other being wrong, they're just seeing things from different perspectives. In actual fact, two people can look at exactly the same thing, have completely different opinions about it, and both be right. If you'll just take the time to explain this to them, you'll be able to diffuse a lot of the conflict which may arise at your company. So rule number two that makes you a win-win power negotiator is to learn not to fall into the trap of assuming that the other people want the same thing that you do. And probably the biggest trap that contractors fall into is assuming that price is the most dominant issue in a negotiation. Subcontractors from coast to coast, from border to border, have told me how tough it is to deal with generals. That all generals want is the lowest price, and if you don't have it, you're not going to get the job. But I've never had a general tell me that they would hire a sub strictly based on the lowest price. Obviously, there are many, many other elements other than price that are important to them. They have to be convinced that the job will be done right. They need to know that it will be done on time. They insist that adequate management supervision be given to the job. How the job will be paid out is a consideration. Does the sub have the financial support that he needs? Does he have the support of a well-trained and motivated workforce? These all come into play, as well as half a dozen other factors. When he's satisfied that all those requirements are met, then and only then does price become a deciding factor. So the third key to win-win negotiating is the understanding that we will never be a power negotiator if we always assume that they want what we want. Because if we do, we further make the assumption that anything we do in the negotiations to help them get what they want takes away from what we want. Let me give you a couple of examples to illustrate this. I got a call from a developer in Seattle who had located a piece of land that he felt would make an excellent shopping center development. And he could hardly believe his good fortune when he felt that the other developers must have just overlooked it. So he got together a group of investors who would be willing to syndicate the development of the shopping center, and he approached the owner of the land with an offer to buy. And what he ran into was absolute indifference to his offer. The person who owned the land didn't say it was a bad offer, didn't say it was a good offer. He just wasn't interested in discussing an offer on the property at that particular time. This is always a big problem when you're negotiating. You're always better off to have a strong objection to what you're proposing than you are to be met with indifference. At my power negotiating seminars, I ask the unmarried people in the audience to answer this question. What's the opposite of love? Invariably, they respond, hate. Well, those of us who have been married know better than that, don't we? We know that love and hate, when you're married, can be this close. But as long as they're throwing plates at you, you have something there with which you can work. The real opposite of love is indifference. They simply don't care anymore. It's when they're saying, like Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind, quite frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's when you know the movie's about over. So what's difficult to handle is when they're just not interested in discussing the problem. And that's the same thing when you're power negotiating. You're always better off to have a strong objection than you are to meet with indifference. So I said to the Seattle developer, okay, quit telling me about the property. I know you're excited about it, but the answer is never with the property. The answer is always with the person. Tell me all you know about the person. He said, well, I don't know too much. He's a very elderly man, evidently very, very sick. Probably knows he's going to die within a year or so. Very, very wealthy. Money is just not an issue to this person at all. He's just not interested in taking the time to discuss the sale of this land. Well, what might this person be interested in? If we get around the other side of the negotiating table and understand that, we can do something for this person that wouldn't take away from our position. If we get away from the assumption that he just wants more money for the property, then we can start looking for creative solutions. And we could very quickly come to the conclusion that this person might be interested in a monument to himself. If he's old, sick, wealthy, and dying, he might be interested in a monument, something that will outlive him. And we're in an excellent position to provide that for him, because we can offer to name the shopping center after him. You see, they didn't want the same thing. The buyer wanted the property for its development potential. The seller really wasn't interested in that so much as he was the monument concept. And eventually, the owner of the land was willing to deed the land over to the developer free and clear in return for a share in the syndication that they put in trust for the man's granddaughter, and the promise that the shopping center would be named after him. That's a win-win solution. But it can only come when you understand that people in negotiations don't want the same thing. They're looking at the same problem, but they're seeing it from different perspectives. In another instance, a man called me from Dallas. He was interested in acquiring a small business. He'd been negotiating with the sellers of the business, and he found that they were fairly flexible about terms on the business. They were receptive to a leveraged buyout, but they were too rigid on the price. So he called me to see if I knew of any ways to get the price down. So I said, quit telling me about the business. Tell me about the people. And he said, well, they're a middle-aged couple with teenage children, and that's really all I know about them. I said, well, they do need some cash out of the business. Is that right? Oh, yes. They asked for at least $4,000 cash. I asked, what are they going to use that money for? He told me, their daughter's going into private college this fall, and they need $4,000 for tuition in September. Now, let's get around to the other side of the negotiating table, with the understanding that we can do things for them that don't take away from our position and consider their problem. They're scraping together $4,000 to pay tuition this September. But what will they need next January? Another $4,000 for the second semester, right? Does it make any sense for them to put their daughter into a private university in September if they're not sure they could maintain the tuition for a second semester? Of course not. They'd be better off to put her in a state university. And what will they need the following September? Another $4,000, maybe a little more. And the following January? In fact, they're going to need $4,000 each September and January for the next 4 years. Now we become concerned about their problem. And here's what the investor in Dallas worked out. The seller would carry back financing, on which he would make payments of $4,000 each September and January for the next 4 years, thereby assuring them that their daughter could go through college. You see, they didn't want the same thing. They were looking at the same problem, but they were seeing it from different perspectives. The investor wanted to control the business. The sellers wanted the assurance that their daughter could go through college. And win-win negotiating can only come when you understand that people don't want the same things in the negotiation. So good power negotiating becomes not just a matter of getting what you want, but also a matter of concern about the other person getting what they want. And one of the most powerful thoughts you can have when you're negotiating with a developer, a general, or a sub is not, what can I get from them? But what can I give them that won't take away from my position? Because people will give you what you want in a negotiation when you give them what they want. Now, please don't confuse negotiating with price cutting. A contractor told me, well, I don't negotiate my fees. I bid a job at the lowest price at which I can make money, and I never deviate from that. Well, that in itself is a negotiating tactic, as we'll see later. But let me suggest to you that if you have a service or product that is non-negotiable in terms of price, you'd better become a very good negotiator. An equipment supplier told me, our prices are fixed. We don't negotiate them. But you still negotiate if you're trying to sell things at full price, and you definitely need to become a better power negotiator than the competitor who is able and willing to cut prices. Conversely, a salesperson with an 8% negotiating range who gives it away all the time is not negotiating at all, is he? So don't confuse negotiating with price flexibility. In fact, many of the speaking engagements that I have are from companies that are concerned about the lack of negotiating that their people are doing, not the amount of negotiating that their people are doing. I was hired by a large company in San Francisco, one of the largest suppliers of sound equipment to radio stations and television stations. They had given their salespeople an 8% negotiating range. From their list price, they could give up to 8%. And they found out that they were giving away just about all of it. After we'd spent a day with them in a special workshop session teaching them power negotiating, they were able to cut that price loss in half. So to someone with no flexibility in price, it becomes a matter of getting them to say yes. Yes, yes, yes. Doesn't that word have a sweet ring to it? Some of the most exciting things that have happened to me have happened just after somebody has said yes. So what is the word no? To a good power negotiator, no is simply an opening negotiating position. The next time you make a proposal to a general and they say to you, that's the most outrageous idea I've ever heard. You must be out of your mind to think that we would go along with something as incredible as that. You simply say to yourself, isn't that an interesting opening negotiating position? And that's where the fun really starts. In this country, we have a real desire to get to the bottom line, don't we? I really became aware of this when, as a president of one of the largest real estate companies in California, we found ourselves doing a lot of business with Iranians, or Persians as they prefer to be called. At the time of the fall of the Shah of Iran, it was not uncommon to find Iranians coming into this country with $1 million in cash, which they wanted to invest in American real estate. Very often I would see our salespeople making gross errors when negotiating with these Iranians, because they would take the typical American attitude of, let's get the business settled, and then we'll go out for a beer afterwards. Whereas the Iranians were taking a totally different approach. They knew there were set stages that you need to go through in every negotiation. For them, it was appropriate to sit down and have some tea together and to get to know each other well. It might be several hours before the topic of business would even be raised. So if we would learn these three stages of every negotiation and learn to work with them, we'll become much more effective. So now let's learn these three stages of every negotiation. This is something from which Mayor Wilson Good of Philadelphia could really have benefited. In May of 1985, he was called into a terrorist situation on LaSarge Avenue in Philadelphia. He authorized the police to drop a bomb on the terrorist headquarters, and as a result, 53 homes were destroyed, 250 people were left homeless, and the 11 terrorists were killed. This situation was of special interest to me because not long before that, I'd been hired by the mayors of California to teach them how to negotiate this kind of situation. There are 442 cities in California, and the mayors held a big conference in Monterey, California, and hired me to come and teach them how to power negotiate. So I taught them that there are three stages to every negotiation. And the way I explained it to them, which was in terms of a terrorist situation, is a good way to explain to you what those three stages are and how you can apply them to any other situation where you have an angry person on your hands. Let's suppose, I said to them, that you're the mayor of a small California city, and you've been called into a terrorist situation downtown. There's a gunman holding a gun on a hostage in one of the buildings. Your police chief is a little to the right of Genghis Khan, so he's in favor of blowing the whole place apart and killing everybody in sight. Somebody hands you a bullhorn and says, "Okay, negotiate our way out of this." One of the mayors called out, "Wait a minute, I only got elected by 47 votes." But in that situation, it would be fairly obvious what the first stage should be. The first stage would be to establish criteria. Find out exactly what the other side wants to do. Even when you're fairly sure that you won't like to hear what you're about to hear, find out exactly what it is they want. Even if you cannot or will not make any concessions to them at all, find out exactly what it is they want. Get them to establish their criteria. In the terrorist situation, they might want 5 minutes on a local radio station. It might be a one-way ticket to Cuba, or the release of some prisoners somewhere, or it might just be something that you can give them. Sometimes you're surprised when you find out exactly what it is they want. I remember a situation many, many years ago when a large department store chain asked me to negotiate a situation where a couple had bought a Franklin stove through their catalog department and installed the stove themselves. It had malfunctioned, blackening the entire outside of their house and pouring hot coals onto their living room carpet, burning a hole in the middle of it. This appeared to be such a major problem to this company that the complaint had gone through all the chairs, from salesperson to store manager to district manager, and district manager through to regional manager. The regional vice president in charge of the 7 western states now had this problem on his desk. In an attempt to negotiate this to avoid it going on to the head office in Chicago, he asked me to go and see what could be done, to take pictures of the damage and assess an appropriate settlement. I went out there to this little home in the country and met with the owners of this home, who were two of the most charming elderly people I had ever met. I quickly ascertained that it was indeed the fault of the stove and not the way that they had installed it. They showed me the blackened outside of the house. They showed me the hole in the living room carpet. So the first thing I did was to establish criteria, to try and find out exactly what it was they wanted to do. I assumed it was a question they'd been asked a dozen times before, as this complaint had worked its way up through the levels of authority in the company. But to my amazement, when I said to them, "What exactly is it you feel the company should do for you?" They said, "Well, we can probably take care of the smoke on the outside of the house. We have plenty of time. We can clean that up. But we are concerned about the hole in the living room carpet." "Well," I repeated, "what do you feel the company should do about that?" "Well, we wouldn't expect you to buy a whole new carpet," they said. "Maybe if we had a scatter rug that we could put over the hole, that would be all right." I could hardly believe what I was hearing. I said, "Do you mean to tell me that if we gave you a scatter rug to put over the hole, you'd be happy?" "Oh, yes, that would be fine," they said. So I put them in the car, drove them down to the local branch of the store, had them pick out a scatter rug, which was less than $50 at retail price, much less cost, had them sign a complete release, and mailed it to the regional vice president of the company. I got back a letter congratulating me on a masterful job of negotiating, which was nonsense. I was just the first person to ask them exactly what they wanted. So in that example, we see how going to stage one, which is establishing criteria, quickly brought the negotiations to a successful conclusion. But now let me relate an incident which is far more typical. In this instance, the person involved didn't know to first establish criteria, and the problem quickly escalated. I was hired by a large nationwide real estate franchise company to talk on power negotiating at their annual meeting. In the morning, they had an award ceremony for the top producers. Then they broke for lunch, and I was the afternoon speaker. As they finished handing out all the trophies and broke for lunch, I saw one of the franchise branch managers come storming up to the front of the room. He grabbed a hold of the vice president of the company and yelled, "Well, you did it to me again. One of my top salespeople didn't get that trophy. How am I supposed to keep them motivated if you don't give them recognition?" He had caught the vice president at a bad moment because he responded, "You know why he didn't get his trophy? Because you didn't turn in your sales report on time." "Yes, I did." "No, you didn't. You've been with us for 5 years now, and you've never turned a sales report in on time yet." And the fight was on. The people who were lined up to try and talk with the vice president started drifting away in embarrassment, and I started to time this thing to see how long it would take the vice president to find out exactly what the branch manager wanted him to do. 23 minutes went by. By then, they were in a screaming match. The branch manager was saying, "I'm going to leave the franchise. I'm going to pull all of my salespeople out, and we're leaving." And the vice president responded, "If that's all the loyalty we've got from you, we're probably better off without you." How many times have you observed that kind of scene on a construction site? A major escalation of the problem when all that it really took was for the vice president to stay calm and say to the branch manager, "Gee, I'm sorry that he didn't get his trophy. What exactly is it you would like me to do?" And the branch manager would have responded, "Well, give him some recognition during the lunch break or this afternoon, would you?" And the vice president could have replied, "If I do that for you, what will he do for me? Can I get your assurance that your sales reports will be in on time in future? Because that's what created the problem." That's a gambit called trading off. We'll talk about that later. And it all would have been over. But we see that kind of escalation all the time, don't we? Not only on construction sites, but also when the general or the sub thinks that they're being taken advantage of over the price of a change order, or when friction arises amongst your employees, or in our personal lives with our spouses and children. Something is said. The wrong response is made. Pretty soon, the whole thing has flared up, and we never meant for it to get that bad. But we just don't know how to pull back from the positions that we've taken in the negotiation. So that's always the first stage in any negotiation. We ask them exactly what they want us to do. In response, we let them know what we are prepared and not prepared to do. We establish criteria. Stage two is to exchange information. Having established criteria so that each side understands exactly what the other side is initially willing to do, then we go to stage two, which is to find out everything you can about the situation. This is one of the most critical parts of any power negotiation, to probe for more information. Find out all you possibly can. Don't jump to conclusions at this stage. Ask for information. In the case of the terrorist situation, we want to know if this person is a member of an organized group. Have they ever followed through on this threat before? What religion are they? Is there a minister or a priest we can call in? Where's their family? Who can we bring in to help us with the situation? We get all the information we possibly can. Whenever you hear about a hostage negotiation where everything went wrong and people got killed, examine the news reports and see if this wasn't the problem, that the negotiators weren't able or simply didn't have the patience to find out more about the situation. Three people got killed when a gunman held up a Van Cleef & Arpels jewelry store on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. The SWAT teams kept the gunman trapped inside the store for 2 whole days. On the third day, they were finally able to capture him, but until they didn't even know his name. So first you establish criteria, and then in stage two, you exchange information. As a contractor, you may have a key employee who's about to quit. What exactly would it take for them to stay with you? Find out, even if you may not like what you're going to hear. Find out, even if you have a firm policy against giving people an increase in pay when they threaten to quit. Instead of flying off the handle and getting all upset, exchange information. Because having done that, you may be in a position to say,
Charlie, we've been friends for 16 years. I can't believe that you'd take a chance on going to work for another company for that little extra money. This employee may be having marital problems that seem to demand that he should leave town. And really, the money he makes on the job is not the key issue at all. Exchanging information is critical to you, and it's the second stage of every negotiation. Only when you've completed these two stages do you then go to stage three, reaching for compromise, which is what most people think of as negotiating. To start looking for things that they might see of value, but which you're willing to concede in the negotiation because they're not necessarily of value to you, and vice versa. Follow those three stages of negotiation, and you'll see how what were formerly big traumatic problems now become easy to handle. Practice in little areas, too. For example, before my son got his own car, he used to come and say to me, "Dad, could I borrow the car tonight?" And I might immediately jump to the defensive. Without going through the stages, I'd say, "No, son, I don't want you borrowing the car tonight. We can't have you borrowing the car every night. You've got homework to do," and so on and so forth. If I'd have gone through the three stages, I would have established criteria. Number one, find out where he's going with the car. When will he be coming back? And then go to stage number two. Get all the information possible. Who is he going to be with? If he's going to a movie, what movie is he going to see? And so on. And then stage three, reach for some kind of compromise that's acceptable to both of us. Such as, "If you do your homework first, I'll let you go." Or possibly, "Tomorrow night, we'll take you to the movie." But before I went through the three stages, I would jump to a conclusion. A big argument would start, and then I would find out that he'd been asked by his mother to go down to the drugstore to pick up a prescription for her, and the relationship would have been seriously weakened. So the next time you've got an angry person on your hands, go through these three stages and see how simply the problem can be resolved. Now let's talk about the characteristics of a power negotiator. There's no such thing as a born negotiator. People who are good at it have taken the time to learn the skills that make them appear to do it well without effort. So what does it take to become a good negotiator? There are five things that I'd like to stress here. Number one, the understanding that power negotiating is always a two-way affair. The pressure is always on the other person to compromise in the negotiations just as much as it is on you. For example, when you're walking into a bank to apply for a business loan, you tend to get very intimidated. You tend to look at that big bank and you start thinking, "Why on earth would a big bank like this want to lend little old me money?" And we immediately lose sight of the pressure that's on the other side. That this bank spends millions of dollars a year in advertising to entice us to come in for a loan. They've got tremendous pressure on them to get those deposits out in the form of loans. That many, many people who work there have jobs that are entirely dependent on the loan activity. So a good negotiator learns to mentally compensate for the fact that we always think we have the weaker side in the negotiations. And as he strides up to that loan officer's desk, he thinks to himself, "I bet that loan officer just got a royal chewing out from his boss, who told him, if you can't find somebody to lend money to today, we don't even need you around here anymore." Remember when you've had a key employee come to you to ask for more money? And what are you sitting there thinking? You're thinking, "I hope I don't lose them over this. They've done so well for me all these years. They're so skilled in what they're doing. I have no idea where I'd find a replacement for them." And they're probably sitting there thinking, "I hope this doesn't affect my career plan with the company. They've really been good to me over the years. Maybe I shouldn't push so hard. He's been so nice to me." You're both sitting there thinking that you have the weaker hand in the negotiation. And good negotiators learn to mentally compensate for that. Don't buy into it when the general says to you, "I've got half a dozen other guys that will do it for less money and do it just as well." Don't buy into that. Something brought the other side to the negotiating table. They've got pressure on them just as much as you've got it on you. And the minute you understand that and believe that and learn to mentally compensate for that, you become a more powerful negotiator. The second point that makes you a good negotiator is the desire to acquire the skills of power negotiating. The understanding that negotiating isn't just for union negotiators and FBI agents and prison wardens. Everybody's negotiating all the time. And the desire to acquire the skills comes from the understanding of the power of what we're teaching you now, the personality styles and the power factors, how effective these can be when you're dealing with other people. Try them out. See how great they are. And you'll have a strong desire to hone your power negotiating skills. When you hear some of these gambits, you're going to say, "Roger, You've never met some of the guys I have to deal with in the contracting business. They make Attila the Hun look like Ann Landers. They're never going to fall for that kind of thing. That's fair enough, but I want you to buy a little Blue Sky from me until you've had a chance to try them out. Time and time again, contractors have told me I never thought that it would work, but it did. It's amazing. And the first time you flinch, nibble, or vice the other person, and walk out of a negotiation with $10,000 in your pocket that you didn't expect to get, you'll be a believer, too. Number three is a willingness to practice. One of the fascinating things about learning how to negotiate is that you don't have to wait until you're in a heavy negotiating situation with thousands of dollars on the table before you work with these skills. Learn to practice in little areas, too. For example, I was hired to do a seminar in Atlanta at John Pittman's Peachtree Hotel. That's a Westin hotel. It's a fabulous place. It's 70 stories high, the tallest hotel in the country and possibly in the world. It's like a round, tall tower with only 20 or so rooms on each floor. As I walked into the hotel, a room had been prearranged for me by the organization that had hired me. I was wondering what I could do to provide an illustration to people who would be in the seminar the following day to show how effective power negotiating can be. So I decided to see what I could do about negotiating down the price of the room. Now, rooms at the Peachtree at that time typically cost $135, and they had given me a very good corporate rate, $75. But nevertheless, I was determined to see what I could do, and 10 minutes later, they had reduced the price of that room to $37.50 for me. I'd used the trading-off gambit on them. They told me that they had a twin-size room for me. Now, if they had said they only had a full-size room, I would have asked for a twin bed, you understand. It didn't matter what it was, but I said, I'm sorry, this room was booked a month ahead of time for me, and I'm just not going to accept a twin-size room. The manager was brought out. He explained that they have 1,400 rooms in the hotel, 1,390 of them were already occupied. They only had 10 available, and I would have to settle for a twin-size room. So I used the trading-off gambit, which I'll teach you later. I said, well, I might be willing to settle for a twin-size room, but if I do that for you, what will you do for me? I thought possibly they might offer a free breakfast or something like that. But to my amazement, he said, we might be able to adjust the price of the room a little bit. How would half price be for you? And I said, that would be just fine. The interesting thing was that right after this, just before they gave me the key to the room, they said, let me check just a moment. We may be able to do something more for you. And they made a telephone call, and they found out that they did indeed have a queen-size room available for me. It had just been newly redecorated, and they weren't sure whether it had been released yet. So I ended up getting a $135 queen-size room for only $37.50. This didn't benefit me, since the organization that hired me was paying for it, and they got the benefit of the reduction anyway. But here's the point. In little areas like this, you can learn to use these gambits to see how effective they can be. And that will be very, very useful for you when you get into large negotiations. In another instance, I was completing a seminar in Kansas City and flying back through Dallas to California. And another speaker at the seminar told me he was on the same flight as me and suggested we travel together. In the taxi to the airport, I found out that I was traveling on a first-class ticket and he had a coach ticket. So I determined to see if I could get him upgraded to first class at no extra charge. Well, it took me 10 or 15 minutes to do it, which probably wasn't a particularly valuable investment of my time, but the thing is to get some practice in areas like this. I told the young lady at the counter, I just ran into this friend of mine, and I have a first-class ticket. Would you be nice enough to give him a courtesy upgrade? She said that she couldn't do it, but that I should check with the gate agent to see if he could do it. So we talked to the gate agent. He said no. There was absolutely no way that the company would let him do that. He was using the higher authority gambit, which I'll teach you later. I said, well, what if I talk with the stewardess on the plane? He said, well, I guess you could talk to her if you wanted to. So I got onto the plane and told the same story over again. I just met this person, I had first class, he had a coach. Would she be willing to look the other way? She said, well, I don't have the authority, but I'll check back with the gate agent, the person I previously had spoken to. I invited my friend to sit next to me in first class while she went to check. She came back and said, that's fine, you're welcome to do that. The interesting thing was that in both of these instances, the other people were not hostile to the negotiation. They were happy to do this. They were happy to make that concession. In fact, when my friend left the plane in Dallas, the stewardess pressed two little bottles of Chivas Regal into his hand and said, please take these with our compliments. The fourth characteristic of a power negotiator is having a willingness to get over our fear of negotiating. In this country, we have a tremendous sense of fair play. We really don't want to take advantage of the other person. When Americans look at a price ticket, we always assume that it's the lowest price for which an item can be bought. Around the rest of the world, they think it's the highest price the merchant will take for the item. In this country, we tend to think that splitting the difference is a fair solution to the problem. Can you imagine that? We propose to the general that they pay $50,000 for a change order. The general counters with $30,000, and our mind accepts that as a negotiating range from $30,000 to $50,000. So if we split the difference and settle for $40,000, that would be fair. Can you imagine that? No wonder the Japanese are eating our lunch. To illustrate our natural fear of negotiating, let me tell you a story. A large publishing organization in New York hired me to teach power negotiating to their executives. They rented a beautiful old mansion on Long Island for a retreat. It's the mansion that was used in the filming of the movie Arthur. Remember when Arthur was driving out to meet with his future father-in-law? There was a shot of him driving up a long, curving driveway. The night before the seminar, the electricity went out in the area. Instead of getting wake-up calls, they knocked on our bedroom doors with candles and beautiful old candelabras, which kind of fit the scene of this beautiful old house. But there wasn't any hot water with which to shower, and when we went down for breakfast, although they'd done a good job of putting out a spread, it wasn't a hot breakfast. During the seminar, I couldn't use the overhead projector, but the light wasn't a problem because we were meeting in a ballroom, which is surrounded by large windows. By now, everybody was getting into the mood of this beautiful old house with no electricity. We got about 2 hours into the seminar and told them, "Let's practice what we've learned. I want your president to go to the people who run this place and see how much he can get knocked off the price because of having no electricity." And the president said, "Oh, come on, Roger. It's not their fault the electricity went off. It's off over the entire area." But by now, peer group pressure was taking over, and his executives were yelling at him, "Go on, see what you can do." So I briefed him on how to handle it. First of all, I said, "I want you to find the person who could make this concession. It doesn't make any sense to negotiate with someone who can only say no to you." As a contractor, remember that when you're dealing with bankers, they love titles at banks. You can be blissfully dealing with a vice president over a little old $50,000 loan and not realize that this person only has the authority to say no to you. Then I said, "Be sure that you don't create a confrontational negotiation. Don't tell them that you are unhappy about there being no electricity. I want you to say, 'I've got a lot of unhappy people in the room. How much are you going to take off the bill because of the lack of electricity?' And whatever they say to you, I want you to look at them and say, 'You'll have to do better than that.'" That's the vice technique, which I'll teach you later. So off he went to the cheers of his executives and came back 20 minutes later with a sheepish look on his face. And I thought, oh no, he's blown it, and it won't be a good example for the seminar. But I had him come up to report on what had happened, and he told me, "Roger, I just couldn't say 'You'll have to do better than that.'" When I found the person who had the authority and asked him how much he was going to take off the price, he looked at me for a moment and then said, "Tell you what, I won't charge you for the rooms last night." I was stunned. He'd just made a concession worth several thousand dollars. Well, I guess he took my blank look to mean that I still wasn't happy, so he said, "All right, I won't charge you for the dinner either." That really took me back. My mind was spinning, thinking about how much this was adding up to. Then he said to me, "Boy, are you a good negotiator. Tell you what, I won't charge you for the cocktail party either." Later, the president of the company sent me a copy of the adjusted bill. They'd taken off over $11,000 over something that he never would have had the courage to ask for if he hadn't been pushed into it. So the fourth characteristic of a power negotiator is the willingness to get over our fear of negotiating. And the fifth thing that makes you a power negotiator is the desire to create win-win solutions. After you study this course thoroughly and apply the techniques, you'll develop a power over people, a feeling of control in formerly threatening situations that will benefit you for a lifetime. Then it's up to you not to abuse that power, but only to use it when both people can benefit. A win-win negotiation.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. Also, don't forget to phone, fax, or call in your order for the Service Sense Tape Series for Technicians. Order today and get a free tape album. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.